This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Greg Shanley. What can you do with all that ice at the South Pole? Well, the last thing you might think of would be to build a telescope. But that's exactly what about 400 scientists have accomplished, led by astrophysicist Dr. Francis Halzen. Actually, the ice is the telescope, and the cubic kilometer of it, undisturbed except for buried sensors, captures the subatomic particle called the neutrino. It only asks to capture one out of a million for scientists to discover new facts about the universe, to especially learn more about the always mysterious dark matter. Today, we hear about ice fishing for neutrinos in a conversation with Dr. Francis Halzen. Later in the hour, the latest agriculture news with Doug Cooper. It's Talk of Iowa in 5 minutes, following NPR and Iowa Public Radio News. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Greg Shanley. A cubic kilometer of ice, millions of tons of ice at the South Pole, may tell a group of 400 scientists about dark matter and other secrets of the universe. The ICE telescope has been in planning and under construction for years, and now Ice Cube, that's what it's called, is doing its job. I reached astrophysicist Dr. Francis Halzen at his office at the University of Wisconsin. Halzen will be lecturing about Ice Cube next week in the Quad Cities.
The concept of the project is actually very simple. We are trying to take a picture of the sky, just like you do when you go out at night and point at the sky. You look, you see stars. And so what's happening is that the stars emit light, and you detect the light with your eyes, and your brain makes a picture of the sky. And so that's exactly what we are trying to do, except that instead of using light, we use a different particle that's called a neutrino. For all practical purposes in this discussion, it's like light, but it's a different. And instead of using our eyes, we use a big neutrino detector, which is sitting a mile deep in the ice at the South Pole. And instead of our brain, we use a lot of computers. And so that's it. So Ice Cube will make for us a picture of the sky mapped through neutrinos rather than to normal light.
Now, I understand this is a cubic kilometer of ice.
Yes,
which
that's what
is
it is.
Is it actually just a big square of ice then?
Okay, so you have to understand, it's the detector is the ice itself. It's already there.
Right.
And it's the ice that stops the neutrinos, just like your eyes stop light and process it through your brain. It's the ice that stops the neutrinos. And when the neutrinos stop in the ice, they make blue light.
Mm.
And so what we actually do is put light sensors into the ice to detect the light that's created whenever a neutrino crashes into an enormous block of ice. And so this information then comes in digital form to a computer center that's standing on the top of the ice and is then transmitted by satellite to my office and everybody else's office who is working on this project.
But what are these light detectors? I mean, what are they exactly?
They've been invented more than 60 years ago. They're called photomultiplier tubes.
Yeah.
And so in our case, they are like, it looks exactly, the sensor looks exactly like a light bulb, except it's a 10-inch light bulb. And it does the inverse of what you normally do with a light bulb. You put electricity in and light comes out. In this case, the bulb detects the light and transforms it into an electric current, which then is transformed into a digital signal that can be sent to our computers.
Now, this is light, then, that's produced by the neutrinos,
yes,
which are subatomic particles,
yes,
and then it turns into sort of an actual blue light. I mean, can, yes, you see the blue light?
What happens is that the neutrino occasionally crashes into an atom in the ice, And then it makes like a little nuclear explosion of which we detect the light.
I see. How far? I mean, do you have to bury these detectors way down? And,
yeah.
How deep are we talking here?
The kilometer cube of ice that's in technical language that we read out where we detect the light is a mile deep. It's a mile deep because there is too much radiation. You know, at the surface there is an enormous amount of cosmic ray radiation, and the measurements we are doing are so sensitive that they would be, the background from cosmic radiation would be too large. So when you go deeper in the ice, you are shielded from cosmic radiation. And at about 1.5 kilometers, this measurement becomes possible. There is, however, another reason. That is that below 1.5 kilometers, there are no bubbles in the ice.
Yeah, okay.
Shallower ice has bubbles, and bubbles scatter light. And by the scattering of the light, you lose the information we are trying to get.
So this is solid pack ice at a mile down, in other words.
This is, in fact, it's incredibly transparent,
yeah.
Perfect ice. You know, this is the ice a mile deep in the South Pole is the most transparent material ever made. We cannot make material in the lab that can match this in transparency.
Who figured this out initially? This has been, I mean, I understand this is, its project has been, a lot of people have been working on it, you and other people, for a long time. But, I mean, who thought of this idea that we can use this huge mass of ice to gather information from outer space?
Well, I thought about it just over 20 years ago. But before I take too much credit, nobody predicted that we would find this incredibly transparent material that makes a perfect, almost perfect, particle detector. In fact, to give you an idea what a discovery this was, what a surprise this was, especially for us, the blue light that neutrinos, that we collect from neutrinos interacting in the ice, travels in the ice over 100 meters. In fact, in some layers of the ice, it travels close to 300 meters before it becomes extinct.
Yeah.
Now, if you would do this experiment with tap water, that same blue light would travel 1 meter. In distilled water, it would travel 2 meters. In the clearest water we can filter, it would travel less than 100 meters. So, I mean, we are not able to distill water to the purity and the transparency than that ice that exists at the pole.
All right, now we're talking about neutrinos.
By the way, this was a total surprise to us.
It was.
And of course, it made the experiment possible.
Did this surprise occur, actually?
Oh, we deployed. I mean, we had the idea of doing this, but it was kind of a shot in the dark. I hope that the National Science Foundation isn't listening to this. And so we were funded, and we built a small exploratory detector, and then we discovered this enormous transparency of this ice. It took us by surprise, totally.
All right, neutrinos are subatomic particles. They can go right through the mass of Earth, can they? All the way through?
Yeah, they do, and they go right through our detector. For we capture about one in a million particles traveling through our detector.
Okay.
Most of them just go straight through.
Right. So what are you learning from the neutrinos?
By the way, before, on the previous thought, that's, of course, because it's so unlikely that you capture a neutrino, that's why you need this enormous detector, right? So you have to make a very big net because most of them get through it.
Okay, so how many you're capturing? How many? One out of a million or something, was it?
One in a million, roughly.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that is enough to actually learn something about the universe then?
We hope so. I mean, this idea of using neutrinos as cosmic messengers instead of light is more than 50 years old. And so, you know, since then, people have been working on trying to develop the technology. And we've finally succeeded in doing that. In fact, IceCube, as I speak, is almost complete. We just deployed the 15th string in this season, in this Antarctic campaign. And so we are close to completing the detector. And it definitely works, as predicted, in fact, better. And so the challenge was always to develop the technology. So we haven't really thought very hard about what we are expecting to see. Or, I mean, this is a discovery instrument.
So why a kilometer of ice? Why is that the magic figure?
I was about to address. So, I mean, we actually have seen neutrinos from the sun, right?
Yeah.
But so, you know, we made great discoveries by studying neutrinos from the sun. On the other hand, I mean, that's hardly astronomy, right? You want to see stars. And so in our case, the type of objects we want to see are things like other galaxies. You may have heard about gamma ray bursts,
yeah,
which are still a mystery. I mean, when they flash for about a few seconds, they emit as much light as the whole universe at that point. And so the hope is to detect these objects that we don't understand very well in neutrinos and learn whole new and different aspects about the physics of these objects.
Dr. Halzen, you were talking about neutrinos. Now, you said they come from the sun, but they come from a lot of other places, right?
We try to make estimates of how many neutrinos are emitted by the objects that we are trying to see. And so one thing we are looking for is, are the objects in space, in the universe, that make the cosmic rays? Cosmic rays are particles that reached the Earth, and they were discovered 100 years ago, and we still don't know where they come from. So one of the exercises we do is we try to calculate how many neutrinos such enigmatic sources would actually emit, and then we calculate how big a detector you need to capture them.
So is the
that leads to the idea. It led to the idea more than 20 years ago to build kilometer cube detectors.
Dr. Halzen, can you hold on a minute? We need to take a quick break, and we will be back talking to Dr. Francis Halzen about the IceCube telescope buried deep in the Arctic, and we'll continue our discussion on the IceCube telescope in just a minute here on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese for Greg Shanley. Now back to my conversation with Dr. Francis Halzen of the University of Wisconsin, the inventor of the Antarctic Ice Telescope, IceCube. Ultimately, are you trying to discover new galaxies? Are you trying to see further into the universe, going back in time further? Is that the ultimate idea here?
The idea is this is the ultimate science. This is a pure is a detector purely constructed for discovery. You know, I always say is that of course when you propose this detector, which we did 10 years ago, that's how long it took. You submit something that looks like a physics textbook that has all the ideas in your cover and why to build this instrument. And I always say the most disappointing result would be that we discover everything that's in that document.
Yeah.
What you really want to discover is something that's not in the document. And so this has been typically the case for telescopes. And people have discovered new ways to look at the sky, and this is kind of the last and the ultimate way to look at the sky, is to do it not just with a different color of light, but to do it with a different particle. And each time a new telescope has been pointed at the sky, people have seen things that are different from those they predicted. They rarely actually saw the things they built the instrument for.
So you're analyzing...
So that would be the success, the ultimate success is, you know... We, Ice Cube is, as I said, almost complete. We have data, limited data, that we have already analyzed. We see a lot of things that we don't understand and that may be interesting.
So what have you discovered so far in this very early... some of these results coming in?
Well, I mean, we are in the game of looking for dark matter.
Okay.
And so for certain concepts of dark matter, we unfortunately have moved the limits by a large amount, but unfortunately not discovered anything. But you can always hope, you know, you keep pushing the boundaries that you detect the particles that make the dark matter. That's one example.
Could you just briefly tell us what dark matter is?
Oh, yeah. I mean, dark matter is kind of the holy grail of physics these days, because we are in this uncomfortable situation that the matter that we are made of and we think the universe is made of is in fact only a tiny fraction, a few percent, of the stuff that makes up the universe. So the holy grail at the moment is, of many of these experiments, including ours, is to hope to discover the dark matter. This wouldn't quite be a serendipitous discovery like, you know, out of the blue I was talking about before, but this is such a fundamental question, you know, that we spend a lot of effort, a good fraction of our collaboration is working on just that question. And for some concepts of dark matter, we are, because of the size of the detector, far more sensitive than anyone was before. And so, I mean, this would justify the construction of the instrument, of course, if we saw any evidence for what makes up the dark matter, and we're trying very hard.
Where is it located specifically? It's in the Antarctic.
Half a mile from the geographic South Pole. And the reason it's there is not because the ice is different from anywhere else. I'm sure if you go 1,000 kilometers away, you find ice that's equally good. The reason it's there is because the National Science Foundation has a research station there. And, you know, we're building a particle detector, and although it's a relatively simple particle detector, it requires an infrastructure. We are not at a national laboratory where they usually build particle detectors. And so we use the reason we are there is we use the station, the South Pole station, to kind of provide the logistics and the personnel and the machinery to build the detector.
So you have a staff down there that's there year round?
Well, it's not just us. I mean, as you probably know, all of Antarctica has, by the Antarctic Treaty, been singled out to exclusively do research. I mean, you can only do scientific research in Antarctica. And for the U.S., this research is managed by the National Science Foundation. So they have various research stations in Antarctica, including a main one at the pole. And it can house about, in summer, it houses about 250 scientists. So summer is now in the south. And so if you go to the South Pole now, you will find about 250 people, of which half are scientists and half support personnel. And about between 40 and 50 at this moment are related to the Ice Cube project.
Dr. Halsin, now that this data is coming in after all of this work on the Ice Cube telescope and burying all these sensors and this elaborate process, looking ahead to 10 years, let's say, I mean, this telescope's going to be working for a long time. What would you hope to find after a period of a few years of analyzing the data?
The ultimate dream is to be doing things in 10 years that you just couldn't foresee.
Yeah.
You know, that's totally new, either from the astronomy point of view or from the neutrino physics point of view, or we discover dark matter, something. The other aspect, however, is we often don't talk about, and I personally feel very strongly about this, we are an excellent detector to detect explosions of stars, collapses of stars in our own galaxy. And one of the highlights of neutrino physics was the detection of the collapse of a star in 1987. And, you know, they only detected 20 neutrinos. They came in 10 seconds from the collapse of a star in the Large Magellanic Cloud. And it led literally to 10 years of solid physics and astronomy collected from these 20 events. I cannot even guess, but thousands of papers were written on these 20 events, half of them very interesting, and the other half interesting. So I always say, with a detector like Ice Cube, where you would collect so much more information, and having other detectors on Earth, like in Japan and in Italy, taking data in coincidence, you know, in 10 seconds of a supernova explosion in our galaxy would be 100 years of science. And, you know, that's the kind of event I really am looking forward to. It didn't happen since 25 years. These bursts typically happen a few per century. So we're waiting.
What about the ice cubes in my glass, Dr. Halsin? Do they collect any neutrinos?
You know, the strange thing about neutrinos is about, you know, literally 100 billion go through your body every second.
Yeah,
and you're totally unaware of it. In fact, to tell you how difficult it is to capture neutrinos, if your body would be a detector, just I was talking about neutrinos stopping in Ice Cube, making blue light. One neutrino stops in your body during your whole lifetime. One and only one.
Wow.
And it won't do any damage, so there's nothing to worry about.
Well, I really enjoyed the conversation, Dr. Francis Halsin, about ice fishing for neutrinos. You'll be speaking in the Quad Cities here in the Iowa and Illinois area coming up in the very near future. I wish you well with the telescope and many years of exciting research. Thank you so much.
Okay. Goodbye.
Dr. Francis Halsin, the creator of Ice Cube. He'll be speaking about the Ice Telescope Project on Thursday, January 21st at 7 p.m. in the John Deere Planetarium Lecture Hall in Rock Island, Illinois. Lecture sponsored by Augustana College's new Center for Polar Studies. I'm Dennis Rees for Greg Shanley. Talk of Iowa continues in 5 minutes with agriculture news with Doug Cooper.
Well, it's that time of year again where we get together with William Edwards, Iowa State University Extension economist, and we talk about income tax planning for the year that just completed, 2009. And let's start the new year. It is the start of the new year, William. Farmers probably are getting all their records together for their annual visit to their tax preparer. What's new this year? Anything different going into this tax season?
Well, Doug, there are no big bombshells this year in terms of tax rules and regulations, but Congress always likes to tinker with the rules, and particularly when they're trying to influence the economy, too. So there are always a few things. Depreciation, that's one of Congress's favorite things to change the rules on. It seems like every year we do some changes to depreciation, and 2009 was no exception. Now, there are really three things that are available to help farmers depreciate assets faster than under the standard depreciation rules. One of those, Section 179 expensing, has actually been around now for a number of years. It's just that the limit keeps going up. For 2009, you can expense up to $250,000 of depreciable assets. That would include farm machinery, as well as grain bins and tile lines and even breeding livestock. Now, interestingly enough, for 2010, that limit is going to be cut in half, back to $125,000. That's the first time we've actually lowered that limit. And, of course, that could always get changed later in the year. But right now, that is scheduled to drop back to $125,000 for 2010. But nevertheless, that gives farmers a lot of flexibility on how much of those assets, because basically any amount up to that $250,000 limit can be expensed off in 2009. Now, once you've done that, we also have a 50% first-year depreciation rule. So anything that's left after the Section 179, we can take another 50% of that as first-year depreciation. And then what's left would be subject to the regular depreciation rules. Now, if that weren't enough, this year, or 2009 only, Congress allowed machinery, only machinery, not other depreciable assets, farm machinery, to be classified as 5-year property instead of 7-year property, which means even what you have left can be written off a little faster. And quite honestly, that's a very minor effect, and one wonders why they even bothered to make that change. But it is there for 2009 only.
Well, some of the farmers had some big hail, wind losses this year. Now, do they have to pay tax on crop insurance proceeds?
Well, yes, certainly they do have to pay tax on those proceeds. The question is, in which tax year do they have to pay the tax? If a farmer can show that he or she normally sells at least half or more of their crop in the following tax year, in 2010, in other words, they can elect to postpone the taxation of those crop insurance proceeds to the 2010 tax year. Now, there is one caveat here, and that only applies to crop insurance proceeds based on yield or quality loss. And certainly for those that suffered hail and wind damage, that would be the case. It does not include payments received due to price loss. Now, in Iowa, a large percentage of our corn and soybeans are covered with revenue insurance, which means it could be a combination of price and yield loss. As it turns out, for 2009, for soybeans, the price actually went up from February to October. So any crop insurance payments on soybeans would have to be 100% due to yield loss. On corn, we had a small 10 or 15% price decrease during the year. So you would have to calculate the portion of the insurance payment that was due to that price decrease, subtract that off, and the remainder could be postponed until the following marketing year.
Now, what about livestock producers? I would think a lot of livestock producers were on the negative side of the ledger in 2009. What are their options?
Well, that's certainly true. We often think of tax planning for people that have above-average incomes, but it's also very important in the years when we have lower income or losses. Their best option is looking at a net operating loss. Basically, if the Schedule F income comes out negative, farmers have the option to carry those losses back to previous tax years and offset some of their taxable income in those years. We can carry it back 2 years, or we can carry it back 5 years. If we don't use all of the loss then we can still carry it forward for another 20 years. So in most cases, farmers do have an operating loss. They can probably carry it back to some of those better years that we had a few years back and actually get a refund on some of the taxes they paid then. A similar thing is available through the income averaging alternative. Income averaging, we simply take this year's income, spread it over the previous three tax years, and if that results in less tax from the previous years, we could also get a refund from some of those years. Another thing that we need to watch in low-income years is that we report enough income to at least use up our standard deduction and exemptions. IRS allows up to $18,700 for a married couple tax-free. That goes up to $26,000 if you're married with two children. And if you don't report at least that much taxable income, now that's total family income, you lose those exemptions. There's no carry back or carry forward on those. If you have significant off-farm income, that may not be a problem. But if you're depending totally on farm income, you want to make sure that you report at least enough to use up those exemptions and deductions.
Other factors, other things farmers should think about going into this tax year?
Well, we have capital gains taxes, taxes on proceeds from property that's sold, that's depreciable property, sold for more than its basis, but also applies to dividends from stocks, could be from farm corporations. This year, or 2009, actually, believe it or not, if you are in the 15% income tax bracket, your capital gains tax rate is zero, no tax. Now, 15% bracket for a married couple, that means your gross income up to about $86,000 would be in the, and that includes the any capital gain income. But if you're in that at that level or less, basically your capital gains income is tax-free. And this is also true through 2010, through the next year. So for some livestock farmers, you need to look at where you are, and it could be a good time to call some extra breeding stock, maybe sell off some equipment that we don't really need. That breeding stock, if it's raised breeding stock, if we produced it at home, basically 100% of those proceeds are tax-free, and it's not very often that we get a break like that from the IRS.
Any final thoughts here?
Well, one other thing. We have an $8,000 first-time homebuyer's credit, and we've heard quite a bit about that, but that could also apply to farmers. We might have a young farmer or beginning farmers that buy a farm. If there's a house on that farm and you're occupying it, it has to be your residence. You're certainly eligible for that $8,000 credit, just like someone buying a home in an urban area. So that's one we want to keep in mind, too.
So it sounds like some changes here. You may want to really going to go over this with whoever works with you on your taxes and make sure you don't forget something.
Definitely. I work with your tax advisor, and this is just kind of a checklist of some things that you might want to bring up.
William, thank you so much. William Edwards, Iowa State University Extension Economist. The 2009 Iowa Farm and Rural Life Poll is out and available on the web. We'll talk about that just a little bit and tell you a little bit about the poll. Let's talk about something here that's, that I think is kind of interesting, farm policy and commodity production. Mm-hmm. Certainly, the two go hand in hand.
Well, you know, 2009 was the first year that the 2008 Farm Bill was in full effect. And so, you know, we wanted to ask a few questions about farm policy. Just to kind of get a feel for how changes or you know, the sameness of the Farm Bill were affecting people out in the field. And we also, you know, have been noticing a continuing trend toward specialized commodity production. And so we put a few questions about specialized commodity production in there. So, yeah, I'm just going to
specialized
share.
Commodity production means what?
Meaning the production specialization in, say, crops, corn and beans specifically, corn and soybeans specifically, or, you know, cattle or hogs. Those are all considered commodities because they can't – we call it differentiation is the economic term, but you can't for example, say my number two corn is better than your number two corn because it's really all the same. So that's what we call a commodity, some sort of product that is homogenous and marketed. You can't differentiate it from others. And okay. So we have moved over the last decades toward a highly specialized system of agriculture here in Iowa. And really, I believe we're the most productive producers of corn and soybeans and hogs in the world, really.
One of the other questions I noticed here, too, is each time the farm bill is renewed, I worry about how changes will affect my operation. Good. That was a pretty significant answer
good,
there.
Good point. Yeah. On the other hand, some of the impacts have been, you know, kind of mixed, and that is a big one. You know, 70% of farmers agreed that every time the farm bill is up for renewal, they kind of worry about how it will affect their operation. And that, I think, stems from, you know, we've got politicians in Washington, D.C. wrangling about, you know, what's going to go in and what's going to go out. And farmers really depend on the farm payments to keep them going over time. And so I think there is a lot of uncertainty because you always have people in Washington, D.C. grandstanding saying we need to overhaul or do away with certain farm programs. And so, yes, there is some stress involved in that process.
They're paying attention when the farm bill is up for debate as well.
Yep, absolutely. We also asked about the relationship between agribusiness corporations and farm bill programs. And we found that about 48%, almost half of farmers believe that commodity programs do favor agribusinesses over farmers. So that was kind of another one of those mixed bag responses to questions about farm policy.
Another question I think that is really interesting to me, if there were no commodity programs, I would still produce the same mix of crops and livestock.
Mm-hmm.
70%.
Would
agreed with that.
Yeah, and we asked this question because a lot of times you hear that people say that the commodity programs are keeping people from, for example, planting fruits and vegetables or nuts or, you know, something besides the commodity program crops, which are primarily corn and soybeans. And what we found is that no, farmers probably wouldn't, at least in the near term, branch out into something different.
Areas of disagreement or strongly agree with disagreeable statements. Maybe mm-hmm. I'm saying that wrong. The shift away from diversified farm operations towards specialized grain and livestock operations has generally been good for Iowa farmers. Not mm-hmm. a lot of agreement there.
That's right. Well, you know, as we see that this specialization trend has been continuing over time, and many more farmers that just focus on livestock or just focus on grain. And so we asked farmers, you know, how has that been in general for Iowa farmers? Has it had positive or negative impacts? And as you point out, very few agreed that it has been good for Iowa farmers. In fact, about half disagreed with that statement and believe that this specialization has not necessarily been good for Iowa farmers. Now, we asked the same question about rural communities. The shift away from diversified farm operations toward specialized grain or livestock operations has generally been good for Iowa's rural communities. A lot more disagreement on that one. 55% of farmers disagreed that this specialization trend has been good for rural communities.
Jay, once again, remind people how they can get their hands on the Iowa Farm mm-hmm. and Rural Life Poll.
Well, it's available electronically at the Extension Store and also on the Department of Sociology, Iowa State Department of Sociology, webpage. We have a special webpage just for the farm poll. All you have to do is type in Iowa Farm and Rural Life Poll. It'll take you right there. We have not only the 2009 summary report, but summary reports and topical reports all the way back to 1982 when Dr. Paul Lasley started this great tradition of the farm poll, which has become an Iowa institution.
Paul Lasley. I've heard that name.
He's a good guy.
Yes, indeed. Jay, come back. I want to talk some more about this.
Certainly.
And we'll look more in detail at some of the more other questions you asked.
Excellent. Thanks,
Dave. Jay Arbuckle is the coordinator of the Iowa Farm and Rural Life Poll. Paul Lasley, Elwin Taylor is here. You know Paul, don't you?
Paul and I have been associated for many years, and sometimes he plays a bass fiddle right before my talk. And sometimes I just delay my talk so we can hear his fine music.
Him and Jack Van Laar have a lot of fun at farm progress shows and things like that, playing piano and bass fiddle. My favorite comment was one year down in Amana. We were having the farm progress show, and Jack and Paul were playing along. And they were taking requests and just playing about everything they could think of. And this woman and her husband, they were kind of walking out. They were elderly. And the woman looked at the husband and she says, you know, I don't think those two guys are playing the same song.
Didn't matter. That's funny. Somebody noticed.
Well, let's talk about the, let's get on the same page with the weather. We've had our high for the day. Am I understanding that correctly?
About, the high was about 2, maybe 3 a.m. this morning here in Ames, at least. We had overnight warming from the high of yesterday. It cooled a little bit as sundown came. Then it warmed back up to warmer than the high for the day had been. So the high for today is higher than the high yesterday at Ames, at least. And then it began cooling after about 3 a.m. And we are in a cooling trend, but not in a bitterly cold trend as we have had over the past month off and on. At the present time, there is precipitation in the western half of the state of Washington, that is from the beginning of the western mountains to the coast, and a little bit of precipitation in eastern Washington as you go up onto the Palouse area, and some scattered precipitation in the eastern mountains of Oregon and down to the Siskiyou Mountains and a little bit south in California. There's a band of light precipitation across southern Illinois and into the Ohio River Valley area, and there is some lake effect precipitation around the Great Lakes, and that is it for the 48 states. We will have, over the next day or two, precipitation becoming rather substantial along the Gulf Coast, mainly Texas, Louisiana area, the way the forecasts look at the present time. The national maps for the weather do show the high pressure over Louisiana right now, and we do anticipate that that high pressure will move aside and let the cold front, which is causing the lowering temperatures in Iowa today, to move all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. We expect it to be approaching the Gulf by 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. Approaching the Gulf meaning more than halfway south in Louisiana. And then we anticipate that it will stay about there until it begins to rain down along that area. The cold front may make it well all the way into the Gulf and halfway down the peninsula of Florida. We shall see what happens with that. Will we have a flow of Gulf air into Iowa? We will not likely, at least before Thursday of this week, which would bring significant moisture into the plains. But even then, I would expect it to be mainly to the east of Iowa. And we would anticipate that we're not going to have any significant precipitation in Iowa, or in, for that matter, in Illinois or Indiana or the Dakotas or Nebraska during the five-day period. The precipitation appears that it will be primarily limited to the northwestern three states and also to the Gulf coastal area. That's the picture as we see it now. Now, is there some good news that goes with that about the temperatures that are going along with it? By the way, the precipitation along the Gulf Coast likely starting in earnest on Friday, going Friday, Saturday, and Sunday of this week. High temperatures from the Continental Divide east, but still north of Arkansas, will be 6 to 12 degrees above normal during the next, well, a 3 to 7 day period for Wednesday through a week from today. That is to 6 a.m. on Monday morning, the 18th. So we anticipate highs 6 to 12 degrees above usual. Southern half of the Corn Belt 6, the near the Canadian border 12 or more degrees warmer than normal. The overnight low temperatures 6 to 12 degrees warmer than normal for this time of year. Now that is a pleasant thing, since they've been running 6 to 20 or 30 degrees cooler than usual for much of the month up to date.
Does that mean that polar front has moved?
It means it has been displaced, and it has been displaced by a flow of air that is coming from Wyoming and Montana And that has some effect that we know as Chinook. I'm not going to call this one an official Chinook, but it's got that same airflow, just not as strong as most people call it when it's a Chinook. But still, it brings a warming as the air comes down off of the mountains. For every 1,000 feet that the air is forced downhill, it warms about 5 degrees. And so coming from a 7,000 or 8,000 foot area down here to a 1,000 foot, we've dropped, it's warmed 25 degrees just because it was the air was pushed downhill. That is the Chinook effect. It has different names other places in the world, but Chinook in our part of the world. Well, how long will this go on? The period of January the 16th through the 20th, that's the 6 to 10 day outlook, is generated by computer over the week's end. We'll have one where humans have interacted by 3 o'clock this afternoon. But the generated one, everything north of Arkansas, and then all of the way east to Maine, running warmer than usual for the 6 to 10 day period. About normal chances of precipitation, except drier than usual in the Dakotas. And on the moist side, as I already mentioned, on the west coast, it will include Oregon, California, part of Washington, and part of Nevada. And on the wet side, in the southeastern U.S.
Elwin, thank you very much. Elwin Taylor, Iowa State University Extension climatologist. We heard from Extension economist William Edwards and J.R. Buckle with the Iowa Farm and Rural Life Poll. ISU Extension, I'm Doug Cooper.